John Lewis is a longtime practitioner of meditation and Buddhism. John's a graduate of Spirit Rocks First dedicated practitioners program back in 2004. In the early 2000s, he taught meditation and yoga at a transitional facility for homeless queer youth. A couple of years ago, he graduated from the Mindfulness for Lawyers teacher training program. He and his husband, Stuart, have been two of the leaders in the marriage equality movement for the last 17 years and have intended their work in that activism to be a form of engaged Buddhism. Both John and Stuart also write a regular column for the San Francisco Bay Times newspaper. And John has been a longtime member of our Sangha. And so welcome, John.
Thank you very much, Carl. And very wonderful to see everybody. And happy last Monday of Pride Month. So tonight I actually wanted to have my talk be a celebration of how lucky we are to be LGBTIQ, two-spirit, trans, lesbian, gay, queer, all the different names for our community and people there in it, and also celebrate allies and friends of ours that are on this Zoom as well. And I particularly wanted to celebrate the aspect of the unique perspective that being queer gives us on the constructs of gender and how it provides us the opportunity to live inwardly and outwardly free from those constraints of gender. I think our very lives embody nonconformity to many gender roles and definitions, assumptions, and of course stereotypes and expectations. It could be, you know, whom we love, whom we're sexually attractive to, or maybe our lack of sexual attraction as well. Could be our physical bodies, our appearances, our dress, maybe our skills or talents, or maybe the way we think or process things, or the emotions, the way our emotional life is. Or maybe how we feel inwardly in terms of gender does not necessarily match how we perhaps outwardly, you know, appear physically into society's expectations of gender. And this is something that I had, you know, thought to talk about for the last week. And then fortuitously, I saw in the news today that Gavin Grimm, who was the trans FTM high school student that simply fought for the right to be able to use the bathroom in his school, just like any other boy, the Supreme Court refused to hear the final appeal from the conservatives of his case. And so he won after 6 years. And he famously, just in a really inspiring speech that he gave as a 15-year-old in front of his school board, you know, one line, "I'm just a boy. I'm a human being." How simple. How simple. Yet how difficult, of course, for society sometimes to just let that be. So it's not the end of the story, of course, of this decades-long struggle, but a day, 6 years, so happy that he won. He's going to get some money, I think, too. So at any rate, and I guess Gavin's story, too, it's yet another example of how our nonconformity to society's expectations of gender, you know, it also causes discrimination and bullying, ostracism, you know, you name it. And I know many of us have experienced some of that, and even violence. But also, as part of this beautiful part of life, our unbound living in nonconformity, free from these constraints of gender that many have to live under, many do live under, it can be an extraordinarily beautiful thing and a really vibrant part of our lives in big ways and in very small ways interpersonally, just very small ways or in within ourselves. And we think about our community too. It's made an amazing contribution to the world, and an irreplaceable contribution to the world. And in a sense, this gift of being gay in society, talking just in generally as people, I think it's a beautiful Dharma gift as well. It's something that's a beautiful Dharma gift that allows us a window into experiencing and thinking about the Dharma and embodying it that maybe others don't have so easy. And so I'll talk a little bit about that tonight. And I also was thinking about, you know, with Sunday being, you know, traditionally in San Francisco, at least in New York and some of the bigger cities, you know, the day for the big pride rallies. But those, of course, those original marches, you know, 50 years ago, they were called Gay Liberation Day, Gay Freedom Day. And so as Buddhists, meditators, Dharma practitioners, what could be better? Yeah, freedom, liberation, freedom and liberation of the mind from the causes of suffering. That is what the path points us to, freedom and liberation from that stress in our mind, that in our psyches, in our psychology, in our mental happiness, and broadly in our lives. So I love this connection between the social and political movement and its origins and Dharma, being free. And that's the last thing Carl usually says at the dedication of merit, may all beings be free. So at any rate, something I think that is very important, though, in making that connection between Buddhism and the emphasis on the root cause of suffering is that, that of course, you know, one of these most entrenched things, as I was speaking about, is gender and gender binaries and gender constraints, and these persist in our society. So, and connecting it more to Dharma specifically, that our direct lived experience, apart from these constraints, these ideas of gender, these ideas and expectations, our direct lived experience, when we get in touch with ourselves and in the coming out process for each of us, we've gotten in touch with that. That actual lived experience is something that's different from our ideas about it and other people's ideas about our experience. And that's something that we're doing in meditation. We are sitting with our bodies and our minds. We're sitting in our direct lived experience, as we just did for the last half hour, and letting go of those thoughts and those conceptions about our experience, letting them go and letting them be here, letting us be here in our bodies and our inner minds. So I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, in the 1960s and 70s. And although Kansas City was probably not the most liberal part of the world at that time or now, my parents actually, they were both university professors, and they did not actually conform that much to gender stereotypes, certainly of the day. And so my dad was an interesting person. He was a professor of counseling and psychology, and growing up, he was the nurturing one. My mother was a professor of classics and Roman and history and Greek and Latin languages, and she was the more analytical one. So my dad was the nurturer, and my mother was the one who didn't really like little kids that much. So, but that's another story. But at any rate, something my dad became very interested in was the definition of gender in his academic work and his teaching. And he really questioned the ability to define gender at all. And so it was amusing. My mother couldn't stand it. She cringed. But when people would come over for dinner, you know, perhaps a colleague of my dad's or maybe a graduate student, we'd be all seated down to have dinner. And then before anybody ate anything, he would just turn to the guest and ask them, "Do you know what sex you are?" And so they were, of course, taken aback. They always responded, of course, on the binary, male or female. But as soon as they responded, it didn't matter which they said, he would say, "Well, how do you know?" And again, whatever response they gave, he would always have a question to undermine their confidence in that label, in that definition, in those assumptions. And I remember, you know, especially if they asked if they knew by their chromosomes, he would say, "Well, have you checked your chromosomes?" And then fire off, "What about transgender people?" He probably said transsexual back then. But he was ready. He wasn't, you know, full confession, I was not growing up in this unbelievable queer paradise in Kansas City. But he wasn't making the connection. Ironically, when he was asking those questions, that's when Stonewall and the first marches in San Francisco and Boston that was going on. But he was really touching on, in a sense, part of what it was all about, undermining these assumptions, nonconformity to assumptions. And what he really wanted to do was he wanted to teach his students who are going to be future therapists not to make assumptions or question your assumptions, question, you know, everything, and question, you know, how we can define things in, you know, all sorts of aspects of our lives, and recognizing there's a degree of arbitrariness or subjectivity about the way our concepts and the way we process the world, that the way we talk does not fully express our inner experience. And communication is among using these labels, these concepts, these abstractions. So what I realized too was that he was talking in a sense to me about a part of, in Buddhism and in Dharma, what we talk about as emptiness. The emptiness of words and the emptiness of concepts, that they don't fully express our direct lived experience. And that when we live in those concepts and live in those beliefs and thoughts and opinions, be it about ourselves, what we're telling ourselves, how we express it to other people, it's not living connected to our direct experience. And when we hold on to those things, hold on to all those opinions and onto those points of view, and we can see it as, you know, LGBT people, we can see it so much as people do that. Maybe we did it to ourselves or within ourselves, you know, in our process of coming out, but how others do it to us. And so I think he was pointing to this idea that these concepts, these things, thoughts in our minds that we can so easily have confidence in and hold on to, that they are empty, as we talk about in Dharma terms. And a Zen author, a modern Zen author, actually an early one from the 1950s, I really like the way she put it. She said, "Zen brushes aside anything, no matter how seemingly trivial, that does not deal directly with reality, nor will it countenance anything less than an individual's own experience." Again, drawing back to our direct lived experience. And so I actually recently have been reading some texts going back in the early Chinese Zen poets that were the predecessors of Japanese Zen. So I had come upon this quote a few years ago, but revisited recently. And so this is, there's the Bodhidharma, is the semi-legendary figure who is credited with bringing Zen Buddhism to China, which it then spread to Japan and then around the world from China. But the Bodhidharma is a great, great semi-legendary teacher, revered in Zen Buddhism. And so there are some amazing, actually, Buddhist caves in central China that are filled with sculpture and artwork. And in the early 20th century, they opened up one of these caves and found that there was a library full of texts in the cave. And one of these texts was, you know, to be a recording of a question and answer session between the Bodhidharma and his students. And so this text, it has some really heavy, dense stuff, like question, what is Buddha mind? What is the voidness samadhi? For those of us who are about to reach nirvana, when one realizes nirvana without while retaining the body, and obtain the fruits of an arhat, is it still awakening or not? So pretty dense Zen stuff. And then I was just reading through these, probably not understanding most of it. And then I saw the next question, and it sort of blew me away. The question was, how can someone who is male be not male? And how can someone who is female be not female? And so I, of course, had to read the answer. And this is the answer, which is an amalgam of two translations that I made to try to make it a little more comprehensible. So this is the answer, and again, I apologize if it gets dense, but this is the answer. So how can someone who is male in the physical form be not male, and female, not female? From a Dharma perspective, the characteristics of maleness and femaleness cannot be apprehended. Maleness and femaleness are not inherent characteristics of form. They're not inherent characteristics of objects of the mind, of the fundamental characteristics of existence. If we look at the sky or at the moon or at a mountain, it's not fundamentally male or female. And that male and female are terms, they're descriptors. They're descriptions of physical matter, just like we use the words grass or trees to describe other parts of the natural world, of physical reality. And deluded people, as it says, falsely think that maleness and femaleness are fixed identities and realities. And they're not constructions of the mind. And if one can see that all constructions of the mind, like maleness and females, of all constructions, are like illusions, they're an illusion, they're not direct lived experience, that you will quickly become one of the most foremost of persons. So, well, I kind of love that, because I thought first, 1,500 years ago, the Bodhidharma is giving name to gender non-binaries, gender freedom, ex-gender, gender fluid, giving voice to it all. At the same time, really, in a sense, I think, and this is where the gift of being LGBT comes in, we've experienced that because we've had to look inside at a direct experience that we know is true about how we love or what is our gender inside, or how we express ourselves, and say all those concepts, those constructs, those rules that dictates all that stuff that we can internalize and that others tell us, that's not true. That's not our direct experience. And when others and when we've clung on to it, it's caused us suffering. It's not led to happiness. And then when we go to that direct experience, live that direct experience, celebrate that direct experience, then there's a sense of happiness and joy that arises. And it's integral to Dharma as well. It's integral to our Dharma practice because if we can do it if we can do that step, you know, that's so hard for that coming out process. It's hard to take, to step into the fear and walk through in fearlessness, because that's the way forward. If we can do that with respect to that, you know, really intimate part of who we are inside and how we love and how we reconnect to other people, and if we can do that, then what else can we do of all that other stuff that we hold on to in our mind and that we've internalized from out there or in there? So I know Armistead Maupin, back in Tales of the City, I think back in the 70s, he wrote that beautiful letter to his parents, the fictional character. He says, you know, if you made me gay, I don't know why, but if you did make me gay, thank you. I really like to remember that amidst, you know, all that we face and all that we struggle, to remember to say thank you. You know, in just a real practical way, one other thing just to pass along very practically, the words male and female and gender, there's so much baggage and so many expectations and assumptions. And, you know, rightfully so, there's a lot of debate and there's all sorts of struggle. There's a lot. And it's important to talk about it all. These are our words. But a friend of mine, you know, amidst some of this discussion at one time, she said that she really, and she's a Chinese-American friend, she really likes to use the word yin and yang. And these are Chinese Taoist notions, and Taoism is part of the fundamentals of Zen Buddhism. Zen Buddhism is actually an amalgam of Taoism in China with Buddhism that preexisted in its forms. So at any rate, but these Taoist notions, if we think about and use those terms in, you know, a modern American context, yin is the softer, the receptive part of our lives. It's the sensitive, expansive part. And yang is the more assertive, more hard part of our personalities and of life itself. And Taoism says that these are, you know, the yin and yang symbol, that they exist within each other and complements of each other. And it's associated in traditional Chinese culture as male and female as well. But I think of it too, and I think queer Chinese, some of them think of it too, is that we, as LGBT people, we have yin and yang both inside of us. We have this gift, again, of having yin and yang inside of us. And that if we can talk in terms of yin and yang in people, instead of women and men all the time, but these forces of yin and yang, as our vocabulary for different aspects of our personality and our lives, then maybe it's a way to free ourselves from some of the friction that using gender terms can cause. So I just wanted to throw that in as something that I had felt found useful, and also it connected to a quote I just love from Lao Tzu, who you know, famously wrote the Tao Te Ching. And is considered, you know, the ancient leading philosopher of Taoism. And this is what they wrote. Those who wish to embody the Tao should embrace all things. To embrace all things means also that one rids oneself of any concept of separation, male and female, self and other, life and death. Division is contrary to the nature of the Tao. Foregoing separation, one enters into the harmonious oneness of all things. And just as that ancient philosophy, you know, from the other side of the world talks about this harmonious oneness, when we can live without that separation within us and without us. The two-spirit cultures of Native America, this land that we live on now, many of them revered LGBT people as a supernatural gift. To me, that's a beautiful thing, that centuries and centuries ago, that the Native Americans, many of them, considered LGBTIQ people to be supernatural gifts. So I want to wish everybody, you know, a happy gay, LGBT, two-spirit, queer, all of them, a happy Liberation Day, and moreover, happy everybody Liberation Day and every day of the year. Thank you so much.
John, thank you so much.